Hello everyone, so I decided to do something new in the history of the podcasting. For the most part, I'm going to be talking off the top of my head, but when I absolutely need to, I'm going to have my Webster's New World Dictionary Thesaurus Second Edition to help me out just in case I feel that I need to be more descriptive in my vocabulary. So let's get to it. After I say this, this will be my new style of podcasting, by the way. I'll be reading little bits and pieces, but for the most part, freestyle off the dome with my Webster's in my hand. Here we go, for real this time. So I decided that when it came to my thinking of adult films for myself, for my survivor thriver community, what I also considered was, and I still consider, how often I would do it. Well, I'm an ambiamorous person. That means that, well, one of the definitions that means that is this: I value having sex in moderation as a non-monogamous person when I'm single. When I'm in a committed relationship, I value having monogamous sex in moderation too. So, as a survivor thriver friendly erotica film global superstar, I value having on camera sex in moderation. And to be more specific, I'm the type of person that values having ethical sex non-monogamously when I'm not committed to anybody. When I'm committed to somebody, ethical monogamous sex in moderation, and on camera, ethical sex in moderation. And I have to say that because we live in the Me Too era. We live in the Time's Up era. We live in the Him Too era, in the Church Too era. So whenever you talk about what you do with another person, people want to know, okay, are y'all of the age of consent laws being honored? Is there enthusiastic, well-informed, mutual consent? And I say yes to all the above, which puts people at ease. And even if we weren't living these types of eras, E-R-A-S, that I mentioned earlier, I would still have these exact same strong sensitivities. So here we go. Next, Antonio, so are you saying that if you are not in a relationship, you would do the survivor thriver friendly erotica films? The answer is yes. Antonio, if you get into a serious relationship, would you do the survivor thriver erotica films? No, because the word committed is self-explanatory. I would have other people live out the ideas that I formulated with the survivor thrivers for the past 13 years in a row and counting. I will say that for me, if I was in a ethically non-monogamous dynamics, and whoever I'm with is like, yes, do the abuse survivor, thriver, friendly erotica films, then I would do so. If they're more like, I just want us to have our sex life, just keep it off camera, then I would do that. Of course, I think for myself, or if they think for themselves, it depends on dynamics that we have. But I do feel that there is a strong likelihood that I'll be able to do survivor, abuse survivor, thriver, erotica films, because of my life scenario, so to speak. I feel that more people want to know, okay, Antonio, since you've answered all the humongous questions in terms of your relationships, they want to know, we got another humongous question for you in terms of genres and categories of erotica. What types would you do exactly? Well, honestly, before I get to that, I want to make it clear to all the consumers and listeners that I would make sure that none of my categories and genres are offensive to the sensibilities of the human rights movement, the equal rights movement, the civil and political rights movement, and the economic, social, cultural rights movement. I would make sure none of the genres and categories of erotica would be offensive to the sensibilities of the environmentalism movement and the animal rights movement. I have to say that because, for example, the acronym MILF, Mother I Like to Fuck, as it is commonly called in mainstream pornography, rubs a lot of women the wrong way. Not every woman appreciates that acronym or terminology. And not every older woman is a mother. So that adds another set of being insulted too. So I would not name any of my categories MILF at all. Next, the word, well, it's become a word, even though it's acronym or terminology. The word GILF, grandmother I like to fuck, that term or acronym or word, whatever you want to call it, offends a lot of elderly women. And not all elderly women appreciate that verbiage. And not all elderly women are grandmothers, so the onslaught of the insulting is what is reoccurring and occurring in that circumstance. The word ebony offends a lot of Black, Indigenous people of color. Not every Black, Indigenous person of color appreciates that verbiage. And not all Black, Indigenous people of color self-describe as ebony. Next, big black cock, that meaning BBC, offends a lot of black men. A lot of black men do not appreciate that verbiage, and not all black men have ginormous penises nor ginormous testicles. Another term that offends many is DILF. Dad, I like to fuck. Not all older men are dads. Not all older men appreciate that verbiage. And not all older men take kindly to that expression, because a lot of older men are offended by that. And we have G-DILF, a granddad I like to fuck. Not all elderly men are grandfathers. Not all elderly men appreciate that verbiage. And that verbiage offends a lot of elderly men. The expression in porn, the mainstream porn kind, big black booty, or they'll say triple B, offends a lot of black women. Not all black women appreciate that verbiage, and not all black women are endowed in the gluteus maximus human region of the physical figure. So then we have the words like ghetto. Not all black people come from the ghetto. Or you have expression like hood. Dudes are hood chicks. Not all black women come from the hood. And not all black men come from the hood either. And there are many people in the hood who are offended by those verbiages. And there are many people in the ghetto who are offended by those verbiages. Because black people are not monolithic. We don't all come from the same environments. We don't all say the same things. We don't all have the same convictions. We don't all believe the same things. And we don't have all the same upbringings. We all come from diverse cultures. And then we have the expression of interracial. In mainstream porn, a lot of times interracial means white women believing all sexual stereotypes about black men, which offends a lot of white women and offends a lot of black men. And when you have white men believing all the sexual stereotypes about black women and black women believing all the sexual stereotypes of white men, that offends a lot of black women, that offends a lot of white men. So the sexual stereotypes of black men that are sadly and tragically glamorized in mainstream pornography is they are virile, sexual Olympians who have two well-endowed penises and massive testicles, and they have relentless energy and aggressive stamina, and they are these big and tall Mandingo warrior thingamajig creatures who just love to ravish and ravage white women as their sexualized forbidden fruit. That stems from the days of the Atlantic slave trade. And that causes the compound trauma called racism. And this is also a case of sexual racism, romanticizing racism, sensual racism, the fetishization of racism or racial fetishization, saying the same thing, and it's sexual racism. It's creating a sense of creating racist misconceptions of Africa and creating racist misconceptions of Europe. And then it gets worse. The sexual stereotypes of white women are that they are these and I don't feel this way, but this goes back to the white plantation mistress compound trauma of her own. A lot of times white women have been made to feel by society that they're dumb blondes that are of immeasurable naivete. But the only thing they know in life is how to woo, allure, and captivate black men. The only smartness they have is in black men. How to engage in disguised smooth speech with racist overtones. And how to have the curvaceous figures that societally speaking, that society does not say that white women have. Usually society would go, well, curvaceous figures is what the Latinas and the black women dominate more than other types of women. So they'll go, well, the black man's nightmare is a white woman who has no big butts, no big breasts, and no childbearing hips. And they'll say, but the black man's international dream is to have the big butt white woman, the big breast white woman, and the white woman with the childbearing hips. This is what North American slavery has done to white women and black men. And the sexual stereotypes of them are just pure evil. And then it gets deeper. And then you have white women are portrayed as sex demons, but black men are seen as sex demons times infinity. It's like North American enslavement caused black men and white women to falsely believe that they're each other's sex fiends. Or we're sex addicts when it comes to each other. That comes from the white plantation man owners, the white man slave breakers, the white man slave owners, and the white man overseers. And the white man slave traders themselves. And then you have the fact that historically white men, white women were angry that their white men husbands would do their own slave breeding with black women in bondage. And so we call that rape today. Back then, that was called an adulterous affair. We call it rape because of the abusive power dynamics inherent within slavery. So the white man would have what is called mulatto children. Nowadays, we call them mixed kids. Back then, mulatto was basically a more dictionary wording at the time in their minds for mixed. So a lot of times the slave owners would have Barack Obama looking kids involuntarily with the black women in bondage. So the white women would get so angry that they would try to have their own their own sexual bigotry culture with, involuntarily speaking, black men. So as long as they weren't, as long as the white woman wasn't caught with a black man, in her mind, this is our private adultery, our secretive infidelity, so to speak. And then, when they were caught, she would accuse the black man of rape culturing her. She would scream out, "I've been raped." And the black man would be sometimes lynched, sometimes flogged, sometimes got the death penalty, sometimes thrown in prison, sometimes jumped and beaten to death by a group of angry white mob men. And sometimes the white slave owner man would say, "Okay, I want to watch you have sex with my wife. And if you don't please her, I'll sell you down south, the deep south, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Texas, Louisiana type south, where the racism is worse down there than it is in Virginia or Maryland or even North Carolina, even South Carolina." And the black man would normally be sexually speaking to the white plantation mistress's liking. And sometimes the white slave owner man would not like it, because not every white slave owner man did that. There were some who lived out that example that I just said. Okay, you have to please her sexually in front of me. Sometimes it was a group of white men going, "Okay, this black man who's being enslaved has sexually pleased this white woman in front of all of us white men." So that there are some examples of that. And usually the black man was to the white woman's sexual satisfactory levels. But if the black man did not live up to their racist sexual expectations, either you were sold down to the dirty, deep, dirty south at that time, or that you will be killed and buried in an unmarked grave somewhere. So that's what happened. Second last example I give is how historically, well, before I go there, there were some white plantation missionaries who would do their own slave breeding with the black men. And that would make some owners mad, some owners happy. I'm talking about the white men who are enslaving black folks. So depending on the owner. And sometimes slaves, well, black men who were enslaved, either they lived to tell about it or didn't, depending upon how angry the white man slave owners were in terms of the impregnating. So the white women would have their own slave breeding farms with black men in bondage as a way of revenge against the white man slave owners for having their own slave breeding farms with black women in bondage. And sometimes the white plantation mistress would either have the black women in bondage live to tell about it or not. And sometimes there were certain cases when it came to the mixed children amongst the white plantation mistresses and the white plantation man owners, they would take their anger out on the mulatto children. Other times they would favor the mulatto children. Oh, you're the only one that's got white blood. You're the only one that's not pure black or pure African or pure Negro, pure colored. Or they said it because they're racist. You're not a poor nigga or a poor nigra. They would put the word nigga and Negro combined. That's how racists talk. I'm just being honest with you about how those white supremacists and white superiority monsters talked. Sometimes the kids got to live to tell about it. Sometimes the kids did not, depending upon the anger of the white plantation family involved. Next, I'll answer the question about the categories. I just got to give you all a reason about why. So, with black women, historically speaking, have been the victims of racist and sexist sexual stereotypes of, oh, they're all Aunt Jemima Jezebels who are whoremongering welfare queens, and their Sarah Bartman type of appearance is the white man's international dream. And if she doesn't look like a well endowed in the breasts, well endowed in the butts, and well endowed in the hips type of quote-unquote sister girl, then somehow she's a disgrace to Africa and she's a disgrace to the Caribbean islands. That's how racist and sexist feel about black women. And they say, well, there's nothing about her that screams motherland. She ain't got no Marcus Garvey black star in her. Again, that's how the racist and sexist misperceive black women. So historically, white men and this happened in slavery days. It was open season on free black women and black women in slavery. They didn't care. You can also say the same thing about many of the white women. It was open season on the free black men and black women in slavery. They didn't care either. So white men sexual stereotypes because of slavery has been, oh, they are these brutes who are angry that Wall Street doesn't completely accept them because most white men don't come from the 1%. They don't come from, most white men don't come from Ivy League backgrounds. Most white men don't come from pristine and prestige. So they feel like, well, the only pristine and prestige I could have is if I land a black woman. You know, a lot of them have been taught, well, yeah, you know, all black women roll their necks and suck their teeth and finger wag and speak in Ebonics and speak broken English and speak slang. This is what their racist white relatives are telling them. So they feel like, well, as a white man, I'm not known to have a big penis. I'm not known to have big testicles. I'm not known to be beefy muscular like a black man is. So if a curvy sister wants to holler at me, a not so good looking cracker, as they would describe themselves in their own bruised consciousness, then yeah, at least I'm somebody. But racists, what they do is, I'll convince you to get with me and make yourself the black self-hater that you are. And I can hate your men, but date you and sleep with you. And there's some black women, black men who go, I may hate your white men, but I'll date you and sleep with you, you white women. And I do this out of self-hatred. Now, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of interracial relationships where they're with each other for all the right reasons. All the sane reasons, all the safe reasons, all the good reasons, right? All the reasonable reasons, right? So you do, so most interracial relationships, I dare say, are like that. I'm just talking about the sexual stereotypes and their deep-rootedness. And there was this view of between black men and even white men that somehow they had to compete for each other's women according to the lawful racism and the lawful misogyny and the misandry against black men at the time at the hands of many white people at the time too. And also when I look at how that there was white self-hatred and black self-hatred infused in the sexual stereotypes because slavery hurt black people the most, but slavery hurt white people too. And then you have, I'm going to go through the other sexual stereotypes. The term BBW offends a lot of women who are considered larger than a size 12, according to society. Not according to me, according to the body-shaming society that we live in. Society is so bad that the term fat-shaming had to be invented. Because society has a social stigma of anybody big. If you're big, they automatically think you're obese, but not all big people are obese, obviously. And not all women appreciate the BBW verbiage. And a lot of women go, well, why is the term beautiful only applied to slim women? Why is thick negatively applied to us? And why do y'all say slim thick? So that's how many women are feeling. And that's it. And there's a they basically try to create sexual athletes out of older women and assume that all older women are that way. They try to create sexual athletes out of elderly women, assume that all elderly women are that way. They try to create sexual athletes out of black men. They try to create sexual athletes out of all white men, assume all white women that way. And they assume that all black men are sexual athletes, all black women are sexual athletes. They assume that all elderly men and all older men are sexual athletes. And then they go, well, women that are larger than size 12, they all are the most super freaks of all time with the greatest fellatio performative streak ever. And not all women larger than size 12 according to society fit these sexual suffocation boxes and sexual claustrophobia boxes. Not all women enjoy the more pushing for the cushion term because that makes them feel like, why are you comparing me to furniture? Why are you comparing me to items? Why are you comparing me to things? Why are you comparing me to baggage? And why are you comparing me to household material and household products? Are you saying I'm as lifeless as a chair? That's how a lot of women feel. And then when you have the sexual stereotype of Latinas, feisty, profane, argumentative, quick-witted. Thinking with their vaginas, and that they are these like these sexual trainees or also these sexual juggernauts. And a lot of Latinas are appalled by that. Then you have the sexual stereotypes of Asian women. They're all submissive. They're not curvy. And they all are good at math. No different than Asian men. You know, Asian men are extremely skinny, no muscle, small penises, and they're good at math too. And a lot of Asian men, a lot of Asian women are offended by such things. Then you have Latin men. Well, Latin men are the Latino version of black men in terms of each and every stereotype. So Latin men and black men are the most Herculean, sexual soldiers. And they have impressive genitalias, and they're both capable of getting the most black women. And, you know, and they're capable of getting the most white women. And Latinos, a lot of them are appalled by that. A lot of black men are appalled by that. And lastly, like, the stereotypes of Middle Easterners and Native Americans, very similar. Oh, bunch of hunters, a bunch of gatherers, a bunch of nature enthusiasts who cause their women to cover up. And, you know, the women that are covered up, the Native American women, the indigenous women, Middle Eastern women, the women that are covered up are the biggest porn performers ever in bed. And these Middle Easterners are built people, and these indigenous people are built people too, and they just have sex on their brain all the time, and they're the most sexually lethal. And a lot of Middle Easterners and indigenous and Native American people are appalled by these. So now you fully understand why, when I create the Abuse Survivor Thriver Friendly Erotic Industry, why I refuse to use any of these terms. Because I will be seen as the enemy of social equality, the enemy of social justice, and the enemy of social equity. Now let's get to the questioning about what categories of porn and genres of porn I'll be in. I'll tell you. I will be doing the tantric sex erotic film genre, the sacred sexuality erotic film genre, the heart-centered sex erotic film genre, the mind-blowing mindfulness sex erotic film genre, the Kundalini erotic film genre, the meditation erotic film genre, the yoga erotic film genre, the Zumba erotic film genre, the yoga erotic film genre, the person-centered sex erotic film genre, the twin flame erotic film genre, Those are some of the genres I'm willing to do. And then I thought about how I have to make this clear. When I go about any erotic film genre, I said to myself, that treating the person as a tool for another's purposes is a hell no. That treating the person as lacking in autonomy or self-determination is a hell no. Treating the person as lacking agency or activity is a hell no. That treating the person as interchangeable with parentheses other objects is a hell no. That treating the person as lacking in boundary integrity and viable as something that is permissible to break up, smash, break into is a hell no. That treating the person as though they could be owned, bought, or sold such as slavery is a hell no. That treating the person as though there's no need for concern for the experiences and feelings is a hell no. That the act of disavowing the humanity of others is a hell no. That the act of treating a person as a mere object of sexual desire is a hell no. That the objectification of oneself is a hell no. That the objectification of social relationships is a hell no. That the treatment of a person is identified with their body or body parts is a hell no. That the treatment of a person primarily in terms of how they look or how they appear to the senses is a hell no. That the treatment of a person as if they are silent, lacking the capacity to speak is a hell no. And lastly, that treating a person as a commodity or an object without regard to their personality or dignity is a hell no. I want to make it clear, none of those human rights abuses will be featured in any erotic film or even compassionate porn that I do. I just felt the need to really say that. And then, when I have looked at how many people are being treated within that world of mainstream porn, my mentality has shifted. Meaning that there are so many people that are tired of what is called the male gaze, and that will not be featured in any adult films that I do. And for people that don't know what that is, this is the compound trauma that women are combating more than any other group of people. And my reading the definition will automatically make sense to you as to why that is. In feminist theory, the male gaze is the act of depicting women and the world in the visual arts and in literature from a masculine heterosexual perspective that presents and represents women as sexual objects for the pleasure of the heterosexual male viewer. In the visual and aesthetic presentations of narrative cinema, the male gaze has three perspectives: that of the man behind the camera, that of the male characters within the film cinematic representations, and that of the spectator gazing at the image. So that is occurring. And that's one of the issues that people have with mainstream pornography. And that's also a compound trauma that I recover from every day because I was exposed to it as a 5-year-old boy. So I'm thankful that more people are warring against the male gaze, and rightfully so. I also, as a 5-year-old, was exposed to the female gaze, because at one point organized crime was ran by women, and when the women took over, the best way to put it, in healthy masculine theory, and I say that because only good men can identify this, not the male pigs, okay? So in healthy masculine theory, the female gaze is the act of depicting men and the world in the visual arts and in literature from a feminine heterosexual perspective that presents and represents men as sexual objects for the pleasure of the heterosexual female viewer. In the visual and aesthetic presentations of narrative cinema, the female gaze has three perspectives: that of the woman behind the camera, that of the female characters within the film's cinematic representations, and that of the spectator gazing at the image. So, in my childhood, I was exposed to both the female gaze and the male gaze. The male gaze more than anything else. And both are issues that are within mainstream pornography. And I recover from the female gaze every day. And I look at my life as this example. Another issue I have with the male gaze is there are analyses of the representation of women as passive objects to be seen in advertising and as nude subjects in certain art pieces. That's one of the traumas I'm healing from. And one of the other traumas I'm healing from is the analysis of the representation of men as passive objects to be seen in advertising and as nude subjects in certain art pieces too. So they're both of those gazes are harmful. When I recognize that both types of traumas have occurred to me, I make sure not to ever duplicate them when I do, adult films. And then I want to include the fact that I have witnessed the LGBTQI+ gaze. So, in my theory, the LGBTQI+ gaze, G-A-Z-E, is the act of depicting LGBTQI+ people and the world in the visual arts and the literature from a heteronormative perspective that presents and represents LGBTQI+ people as sexual objects for the pleasure of the cisgender heterosexual viewer. In the visual and aesthetic presentations of narrative cinema, the LGBTQI+ gaze has three perspectives: that of the cisgender heterosexual behind the camera, that of the LGBTQI+ characters within the film's cinematic representations, and that of the spectator gazing at the image. And the analysis of the representation of LGBTQI+ people as passive objects to be seen in advertising and as nude subjects in certain art pieces. So that was one of the compound traumas that I witnessed as a child. And I recover from that each and every day too. So these are adult film issues and societal issues as well that I'm telling you about. So I have another theory. In my theory, the non-binary gaze is the act of depicting non-binary persons in the world in the visual arts and in literature from a cisnormativity perspective that presents and represents non-binary people as sexual objects for the pleasure of the cissexism viewer. In the visual and aesthetic presentation narrative cinema, the non-binary gaze, GAZE, has three perspectives: that of the heterosexist behind the camera, that of the non-binary characters within the film's cinematic representations, and that of the spectator gazing at the image. And I present analysis of the representation of non-binary persons as passive objects to be seen in advertising and as nude subjects in certain art pieces. So all these types of gazes, GAZES, will be totally eliminated. And when it comes to adult films, I do like, they'll never show up in any adult films that I personally do. And so I also need to tell you this, that I have truly been listening to anti-porn, anti-sex work people. Now, I am a pro-ethical erotica, pro-ethical porn type of person, and I'm a pro-ethical adult sex work type of person. But that doesn't mean that people that have differing views than I don't have legitimate points, because they do. And so I remember studying their views, and their views has some merit to it. Like, I do recognize that within a lot of mainstream porn, not all, that there has been some instances of rape culture, sexual aggression being seen as pleasurable for the victim, and the increasing of the acceptance of the use of rape culture, coercion, and sexual relations. In some mainstream porn circles, that is a hard truth. A hard truth as in a brutalizing aspect of mainstream porn. Not all mainstream porn companies are guilty of that, but some are. And I do recognize that in some mainstream porn circles, but not all, there has been the acceptance of rape culture, coercive sexuality, appearing to be related to the rape culture, sexual aggression. And in some mainstream porn circles, but not all, there has been some exposure to the rape culture, violent pornography, which increases punitive behavior towards women, men, LGBTQI+ people, non-binary people, and even children. There has been, because of some of the mainstream porn that's out here, there has been instances where the children and adolescents who participate in the production of the rape culture type of pornography, there was the experience of adverse enduring effects. That is very true. Based upon my research and me getting to know people, there has been some instances where mainstream pornography, not all the companies, but many mainstream porn companies have failed women, have failed men, have failed children, and have failed LGBTQ+ people, have failed non-binary persons, and failed miserably all these kinds of people, actually. And then there has been instances where, in some mainstream porn, but not all, you know, the prolonged use of the rape culture type of pornography, not the healthy kind of pornography, increases beliefs that less common sexual practices are more common. So I can agree with the anti-porn movement on some things, because mainstream porn has not done a particularly excellent job of truly understanding that what they're putting out has made it easy for some people to be anti-porn because of the human rights violations within certain porn entities. And in some instances, not all, because of within mainstream porn, not all companies are guilty of rape culture, but some are, which means that in certain cases, not all cases, there is a causation of delinquent or criminal behavior because the exposure to explicit rape culture sexual materials. And in a lot of ways, a lot of people have not done a good job of protecting young people from exposure to them. And that adults have not properly adjusted the sense of, okay, adult communication is what we do. Not everything we do, children should be around what we do. And in certain cases, it has been easy to have children, disgustingly so, lie about their age when you enter a porn site and they see things that will change their lives for the worse. And I can admit that the anti-porn movement is right on some things. And I can admit that some of the things they say, that's something that me and other abuse survivor thrivers have talked about. We want to make sure that any adult films that we do as abuse survivor thrivers, there is no bodily integrity violations or bodily autonomy violations either. And we've also studied the feminist sex wars, and for me, I can admit that even though I am a sex positive feminist myself personally, and the survivors I talk to are that as well, what I have noticed is sadly, even in a lot of mainstream porn, there is the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of women through pictures or words or videos. Sadly, in some mainstream porn, there is the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of men through pictures or words or videos. Sadly, in some mainstream porn, there is the graphic, sexually explicit subordination of LGBTQI+ people through pictures or words or videos. And There has been the graphic sexual explicit subordination of non-binary people through pictures or words or videos. I can admit that these things happen, and yes, in some mainstream porn, sexual violence against females happen. In some mainstream porn, sexual violence against males happen. In some mainstream porn, sexual violence against LGBTQI+ people happens. And in some mainstream porn, sexual violence against non-binary people happens. And in some mainstream porn, sexual violence against children has happened. Notice I say some and not all, because I do my best now and forevermore to stay away from generalizations and blanket statements. And yes, there is in some mainstream porn, there is a distorted view of the female human body and female sexuality. yes, and when I say yes, I'm acknowledging it. That does not mean I'm condoning it. In fact, me acknowledging it is my form of rebuking it. So I'll say this. There has been the distorted view of the female human body and female sexuality in some mainstream porn. Of the non-binary human body and non-binary sexuality in some mainstream porn. In some mainstream porn, some, but not all, has contributed to the hatred of women, the hatred of men, the hatred of LGBTQI+ people, the hatred of non-binary people, and the hatred of children. And I've recognized that some mainstream porn has a history of the sex trafficking of women, the sex trafficking of men, the sex trafficking of LGBTQI+ people, the sex trafficking of non-binary people, and the sex trafficking of children. So, there has been in some mainstream porn, there has been enticement to the rape of children. That in some mainstream porn, there has been enticement to the rape of women. In some mainstream porn, there has been enticement to the rape of men. In some mainstream porn, there has been enticement to the rape of LGBTQI+ people. And in some mainstream porn, there has been enticement to the rape of non-binary persons. So, mainstream porn has... some mainstream porn has done these things. And I get what the anti-porn people are saying. So I've studied how they felt, and it has made me more sensitive to sex work related issues and human body issues and human inner life issues. And I must admit that there in mainstream porn, in some mainstream porn, I'm still working on not making all or nothing statements. In some mainstream porn, there has been the sexual objectification of women, the sexual objectification of men, the sexual objectification of LGBTQI+ people, the sexual objectification of non-binary people, and in certain instances, the sexual objectification of children. So yes, in some mainstream porn, there has been the rape myths of women, the rape myths of men, the rape myths of LGBTQI+ people, the rape myths of non-binary people, and in certain cases, they've applied even rape myths to children. So how do I feel about anti-pornography feminists and anti-sex work feminists? Well, I love them. I can be excellent true friends with them. I'm not offended by them. I'm not offended by their views. They are coming from a compassionate place. It's okay that we agree to disagree on prostitution. We can agree to disagree on BDSM, and we can agree to disagree on sexuality. So they would say that prostitution is completely bad. I would say prostitution can be ethical if done correctly. They would say that BDSM is just awful, while I say, well, ethical BDSM, if done correctly, can happen. And they would have more of the traditional views on sexuality, while I say, well, sex positivity ethically covers everybody. So we would lovingly disagree with each other in such things. But I would say that I do agree that there are exploitive practices of the mainstream porn industry in terms of some of the entities. So I can agree with them on a lot of things. And so actually anti-porn people, anti-sex work people, I'm pro-porn and pro-sex work, as y'all know, but I recognize that I learn from people who have different views than I do. And the reason why I don't take it personally is because when it comes to their passion for people to be safeguarded and in terms of the body and the soul, that's why I don't take it personally. Even though I respectfully disagree with them, I'm not in an uproar about them. Because I do recognize that there's been a lot of crooks within the sex work world who have caused all of these chaotic circumstances that have harmed countless numbers of people. So I totally get their anger. Even though we would agree to disagree on censorship, they're more into, hey, you know, any kind of sexual expression, video form, you know, just no. Well, I'm more of, well, if it's human rights honoring, let it be shown. So I feel like, for me, that I feel like pornography can be healthy. And I'm pro-erotica because erotica can be healthy. And I feel that, you know, many people with anti-porn, anti-sex work views would may even disagree with me on erotica. But I respect that. Mine is, to me, erotica does not have to be vulgar, does not have to be profane, it does not have to be socially offensive, it does not have to be obscene. And I would say the same. Porn does not have to be profane. Porn does not have to be vulgar. Porn does not have to be socially offensive, and porn does not have to be obscene either. So I feel like sad to say, in some mainstream porn, it has been used by men as a guide to hate, abuse, and control women. In some mainstream porn, porn has been used by women as a guide to hate, abuse, and control men. And in some mainstream porn, pornography has been used by cisgender heterosexuals as a guide to hate, abuse, and control LGBTQI+ people. In some mainstream porn, pornography has been used by cisgender heterosexuals as a guide to hate, abuse, and control non-binary people. And in some mainstream porn, pornography has been used by adults as a guide to hate, abuse, and control children. And that's rough for me to say. Now, I want to say that there has been I can see why some, the feminist perspectives on sex markets and the sex industry. Of course, I would agree to disagree with the anti sex industry feminists on the subject, because there have been instances where that you can be a sex worker not because of past trauma. You can be a sex worker not because of past child sexual abuse. You could be a sex worker not because of drug addiction. You could be a sex worker not because of extreme poverty and not because of a lack of opportunity. You could be a sex worker not because of human trafficking. And you could be a sex worker not because of coercion by a pimp. So I feel that people go into sex work for numberless reasons. So sex work reasons are not monolithic, and sex workers are not monolithic. So there are people who do sex work because it's naturally their thing to do, not because of pain and not because of injustice. They had it good in life. Some have chose to do that. I must admit, the sex work world that I grew up in as a child, there was male dominance over women, female dominance over men, adult dominance over children, and in rare instances, children dominance over adults. So I recognize that the anti pornography feminists, I would agree with them in terms of their statements regarding the organized crime version of the sex industry. I would agree with them when they go at organized crime figures in the sex industry. I'm like, okay, that makes sense, because their type of sex industry is shitty. But the ethical adult sex industry, none of these things happen. So there's two types of sex industry in my mind. I don't mean to create a binary, but I feel that there's at least two types. There's the organized crime version sex industry that you see in movies and television that is rape culture. Then you have the ethical adult sex industry where sex positivity is the centrality of it. So I agree with the anti-sex work feminists when it comes to their views on the organized crime sex industry, but I disagree with them lovingly when it comes to the ethical adult sex industry in terms of their views on it. I feel like And the last statement is that for me, the commodification of LGBTQI plus bodies, the commodification of women's bodies, the commodification of non-binary bodies, the commodification of children's bodies, and the commodification of men's bodies did happen in the organized crime sex industry that I grew up in as a 5-year-old, and none of these forms of commodification are socially acceptable in the ethical adult sex industry. It's best for me and wise for me to end on such a neighborly note.